Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. Welcome in to the Storycraft Cafe. I am your host, Hank Garner. Today, I am really, really excited to have Celeste Barkley on the show with me today. Celeste, you might also know her as Sabine Barkley. She publishes under both of those names and for different reasons, and we'll get into that in just a little bit. If you like historical romance, let's see all of the different ways we can describe what you do, Celeste. Historical romance, Highland romance, Regency romance, we dip into that as well, mob romance under Sabine, and probably nine other things that you have dipped your toes in. If you like any of that, Celeste books are going to be something that you're really going to fall in love with. Celeste has a brand new release under Celeste Barkley, Highland Love Comes Calling. I knew I was going to stumble all over that. And that's the first book in the House of Clan Sutherland series, a new series just starting off. So if you're, if you like to start at the beginning and follow along, that's a great place to jump in. Under Sabine, you had a new release. And what is that release that's just about a week old, Celeste?
It's called Mob Boss, and it is the first installment in the O'Rourke Brotherhood.
Love it. Love it. Celeste, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. I'm excited to chat with you today. I love to start our conversations with a fun question to kind of set the tone. And one question that I love asking people is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
You know, I will be honest, I did not aspire to be a storyteller or an author. It was something that I stumbled upon. So it would have been probably somewhere in 2017, I'd been reading a bunch of historical romances written by authors who are now friends of mine. That's kind of trippy. And it struck me one day, you know, I'd been an educator. I've read a lot. I figured I've taught literature. I've taught composition. I've read a gazillion books. I got an idea for a story. Let's go for it. So it wasn't a childhood aspiration at all. So my first memory is only from about 7 years ago.
I love that. I've heard from a lot of people that, you know, they didn't necessarily aspire to be writers, but then they really got into a certain genre of book or, you know, whatever it was, but just kind of went deep. And then a lot of times these people will be reading a book and think, oh, I can do better than this. Now, since you're now friends with a lot of those writers, hopefully you don't have a horror story like that. But did you ever have a moment sort of like that where you're like, oh, I can do this? Like, this is not a hill too high to climb. I love these kinds of stories. Surely I can do it. Like, what was your entree to that?
So as a kid, you know, to fall asleep, I would have, you know, like these little made up stories in my head, like vignettes. And I just thought nothing of it. It was the way that I kind of unwound and fell asleep. And it's always been that way. And after a while reading Highlander stories, I started having these little vignettes in my mind that were about Highlanders. And I've always had the rule now that if the same idea comes to me twice, and it might be an opening scene, it might be somewhere in the middle, but if it comes to me twice, that's the basis for a story. So it wasn't so much, I think I can do better. It was more like, oh, I think I could do this too. And actually, I'm way more creative than I thought I was. I thought my creativity was like dead in the water years ago. So it was more along the lines of, I want to do this too, not so much, I want to do this better. Which is interesting because I'm a highly competitive person, but it was just more of like, I want to do it too.
But it was an encouraging feeling, not a competitive feeling.
No, I'm very competitive with myself, and I am competitive with others, but it was more along the lines of, wow, this seems pretty awesome, and I think I have a story to tell. Let's see what happens.
I love it. With the stuff you were reading to begin with, did you know at the time if it was indie published, whether it was traditionally published? Did those sorts of distinctions mean anything
to you? I didn't even know what that was. Yeah. I didn't know the difference between trad and indie at the time. I didn't know that indie existed. I figured it was all part of the big five. Well, big three-ish. Yeah. I didn't know. It wasn't until I was ready to start publishing my own books. And because I'm slightly competitive and a little bit of a perfectionist, I'm a Virgo, I have a fear of rejection. So I decided I didn't want to query because I didn't want somebody to tell me no. Figured readers would do that. So when I started investigating what my options were, that's when I discovered what indie was. But before that, I had no clue that a number of the authors that I loved, that I devoured, were completely indie. There's no difference in quality at all. They are both on point.
So as you started, so let's kind of qualify a little bit of that, that you said when you started learning about publishing, had you written the book yet, or was this kind of all part of your getting into the world and kind of learn, were you writing and looking into publishing? Like, were you thinking along that spectrum, or were you just trying to tell yourself a story to begin with?
So I am generally not a particularly whimsical person, but I wrote my first book on a whim. I mean, I told no one. I didn't tell my husband. I didn't tell my best friend. I didn't tell my parents. No one. Because again, that fear of failure and rejection, I figured if I was going to fail, I would fall flat on my face in private. Sure. So I wrote this first book, His Highland Lass, and I had, you know, this idea for a story and an idea for this series. And I wrote it, and then I went, well, now what? Like, I have it. And this is not typical of me. Usually I'm a very strategic person. I like to have a plan, you know, in place with, you know, four contingencies and possible consequences to all of those. But this go around, I just kind of like tossed it out there and went, well, now how do I get people to actually read it? And it was between books two and book three that I really learned the business. You know, book two came along and I was kind of like, yeah, I really enjoy this, but, you know, nothing's really happening. How do I make the change? How do I get people reading these stories? And so I did everything I could to study the business, and it took off from there. And within a year and a half, I left teaching after a decade and a half. And now I write full time.
So. Okay. So I have to ask you this as an educator. And I'll qualify this. My oldest son is an English teacher who also writes and publishes, and his wife is also an elementary school educator. So we have educators in the family. When you began writing and really began, you know, the process of telling a story and writing a book with a beginning, middle, and end, and, you know, understanding the structure of it because you're a reader, but as you're writing, did you ever think, how do I phrase this without it sounding, did you ever think, okay, I have been teaching my children correctly, or did you think, oh, this is what the rules are that we teach kids? You know, maybe this is not the best way to go about writing a novel. Or did you ever have any of those kinds of senses, like the things that we teach kids, is that the reality of it? Or were you encouraged that, you know, I do know the fundamentals because I learned this and now I teach it to kids, and here's how I go about it? Did any of that ever cross your mind?
You know, so I highly believe that the more you read, the more you intuitively understand storytelling.
Absolutely.
You understand what a sentence looks like. If you understand a sentence, you understand a paragraph. If you understand a paragraph, you understand a chapter. If you understand a chapter, you understand a book.
Right.
So that's fundamentally true across fiction, nonfiction. right? That's just how we learn. The more experience we have with something, the easier it becomes, the more ingrained it becomes.
Right.
The things that I taught when I taught high school and I taught middle school were primarily analytical writing. Okay. I admit I really did not like teaching personal narrative because I didn't want to hear about people's summer vacation. I just didn't, and I didn't want to have to grade them on it. So the creative writing part of it was not something that I taught. I've not taken a creative writing class since I was in middle school, and that was many decades ago. So for me, I've always told students that the five-paragraph essay, which is, you know, the standard form of composition for high school students, is to teach you what goes in an essay. Right? It's not the end all be all. It's not the way that you're always going to write, especially if you go on to higher academics, but it helps you to understand the fundamentals. And I think that's the case when you are teaching literature in general. You know, it's not the end all be all for how to interpret something. It's more about learning how to do it. So yeah, do I start sentences with conjunctions? The time. I do. And I'm okay with that. You know, I don't feel like I need a comma before two independent clauses, like that's come and gone. But it's never been about a rigid structure so much as making sure that you understand what you're doing in order to convey a message to readers. And that's the case for fiction, nonfiction.
Noted. I think that was a great answer. Thoughts on plotting versus pantsing? You know, because writers, we love to stick people in one camp or the other. I have a personal opinion about this, and I'll share it with you after. But what do you think about, are you a planner or are you a pantser? Does it matter to you?
So when I write nonfiction, I am very much a plotter. Like, I need to know what arguments I'm going to make, what evidence I need to have, what order it's going to go in, so that there is a logical progression and nothing is left out. On the creative side of fiction, who knows where the wind is going to blow today? We'll see. You know, I do believe that no matter how much of a discovery writer or a pantser or a planter you are, there's still elements of plotting involved when you're brainstorming. You may not write it out, but as you're coming up with ideas for your story, whether it's at the beginning or as you progress, that is a form of plotting because that is part of the writing process. Brainstorming begins, you know, before drafting does. Am I somebody who writes things out and follows beat sheets and things like that? No, that is sensory overload to me. So I will get kind of a general idea of the story arc. I might jot it down on a Freytag's pyramid, you know, the inverted V, because that's what I spent many decades teaching. So it's what I know. And who knows where it's going to go from there, but that was just sort of my brain dump brainstorm. So I think both, you know, plotting and pantsing and whatever is to the shades of gray in between is perfectly acceptable. We all write in different ways. We all craft stories in different ways, but the outcome is readers like what we do. So how you get there, you know, you do you. So right. I don't feel like one is right or wrong, but I definitely for fiction lean way into pantsing.
Gotcha. I over the last few years, I have learned the value of having a plan, and I hold that very loosely. I like to think of it as like a road trip. If I'm going from South Florida and I want to wind up in Washington State, you know, exact opposite corners of the country, I may go up Florida and then go along the south and go over to Dallas and then turn north and go up that way. You know, I've got some points that I know I'm going to hit, but the adventure is between the points and kind of, you know, allowing yourself to kind of see where the road takes you from there. So I like knowing where I'm ending. I like to know some of the high points and some of the low points, but then figuring out how to get there is some of the fun. So, having some mystery in the writing is part of the fun of writing.
You know, like I said, sometimes the vignettes that will come to my mind that spur the story are mm-hmm. not the opening scene. So I want right. to find a way to work to that, you know, that point. And again, I kind of have an overall idea of the story, but I don't hold myself to that at all. If I start to feel a little bit stuck, then I'll go back to it and see, you know, like, hey, am I still on track for any of these things that I originally right. thought? Oh, yes, I am. It's not in the same order, but I guess we can get to here and then we'll see where we go. But I'm not married to it. I write in pencil.
but, I like that analogy. You know,
I can dissect a story very well and very easily. But as far as the creative side, I don't deal well with beat sheets and things like that because I simply don't know in advance where things are going to be. And I could regiment myself and make myself figure out how to do yeah. beat sheets, but I work for myself. So why? Right. Nobody's telling me I have to. So right. I'm going to do what I want.
Sure, sure. You said that you began publishing 2016, 2017?
I wrote the first book. I started the first book in July, August of 2017. I published okay. it on April 15th, 2018. I always say okay. it's better to celebrate that than taxes. So
say that again.
Yeah. So I'm coming up on my 6th anniversary in 13 days.
Nice. Well, happy anniversary. Happy book birthday, whatever we call it. A lot has happened in those 6 or 7 intervening years in publishing. We see, you know, tide changes in the industry. What things have changed that have affected the way you write and publish? You know, even though it from the outside, it looks a lot the same, but on the inside, lots of things have changed since then. What things have affected the way that you write and publish?
So I have always rapid release. That is one of the reasons why when I discovered indie, I was like, this is for me because I have a lot more stories to tell than 1 or 2 a year.
Sure.
You know, to the tune of double digits most years. So when I first got started, I could rapid release and it wasn't, you know, a big deal whether I did or I didn't. You know, historical mm-hmm. romance is still a very full genre. There's plenty of books coming out, but I could take a little bit more time if I wanted to, because that window of a new release truly was 30 days. You know, at the time I would release at 99 cents and it would pop me up with an orange banner for number one new release. About a week in, I'd kick it up to full price. I'd still have that banner for the full month, right?
Wow.
Now that tail is like a week. If I don't push hard consistently, then I watch my rankings, you know, climb. And it is different between contemporary romance and historical romance. They do have their own features, even though they are under the broader umbrella of romance. But generally speaking, I think the compulsion to continue to write and release frequently is something that a lot of people feel, because the power of your backlist isn't the same as it was when I first started publishing. Right? That if you had a sizable backlist and you were still publishing consistently your front list, you could push people through and you would be, you know, good to go. And I still strongly believe in a backlist, but there's so many books being published these days that, you know, you get these voracious readers who have read everything of yours and you need to keep, you know, feeding the beast, if you will, or else it, you know, they find someone else.
Sure.
And so you want to be there frequently enough that inevitably they're going to go to other authors, but they're not going to forget about you. Or right. you've built such a loyal readership that if you do slow down, they know you, they're going to come back to you, but that takes time. So I've just noticed that the longevity of the power of a new release has changed, and that in many cases, in order to maintain that tail, you either have to have a substantial readership already with a very powerful communication system, usually your newsletter, but maybe your social media, or you have to be willing to pay. You have to, you know, run ads, things like that. Yes, it is possible to do things organically. I'm not going to say it's not. But in the general scheme of things, for the majority of people, it is pay to play. Whether you are paying for ads or you would be paying yourself if you were, you know, your own assistant to do these things.
Sure.
It's not a simply put it out there and coast to the same extent as it was 7 years ago. I mean, it's always been work. It's always been a business, but right. It definitely feels different. I know I feel a different sense of pressure for my publication cycle than I did when I first got started. So,
I think it can be jarring for new authors sometimes to realize that it is a business. I think so many people write that first book because they have a passion for it. They're readers. They have stories that have deeply affected them. And then they feel like, I have a story to tell that I think will deeply impact someone else. And there are all these warm, fuzzy feelings around storytelling and putting a book out there. And, you know, I'm going to make a difference in just one person's life. And, you know, this is going to be, you know, amazing. And then you start realizing, well, now I have to be a publisher also, and I have to promote this book, and I have to, you know, do podcast interviews, and I have to develop a mailing list and maybe a social media presence, and I might have to pay for ads, and this is not what I wanted to do. Can you talk for just a moment about balancing those things, about being a passionate writer? And a passionate writer, you know, and you talked about the passion of story ideas. And if it comes to you more than once, you know, this is something that you have to write. And you said that there are way more stories that you want to tell than you'll ever get around to. There's a passion in the writing, but there also has to be a passion for the business of it, or no one will ever read those stories. Mm-hmm. Can you talk for just a second about how you balance those two things and not getting discouraged in your artistic pursuits while, you know, having to make a living with your passion?
You know, I want to preface this by saying that the publishing industry is obviously not what it once was. So if you are interested in pursuing a trad deal, thinking that the onus will be on them, hate to break it to you, sweet pea, that ain't the way it is. You know, even if you go trad, a lot of the marketing and advertising is going to be on your shoulders. Like, unless you've got a good advance and they think they're going to recoup an investment in you, you're not going to get the end cap at Barnes & Noble. Right. You're not going to get the entryway table. You're not going to get the book tour. You are going to get some built-in support. But just to make it clear that the playing field of necessity is even there, whether you're trad, indie, hybrid, or whatever, we all have to do something. And the moment that switch flicks and you realize that this is a business, that's when you have the potential to succeed. That mindset of it, whether you just want to make a little extra money or you want to pay for a vacation or you want to put it away for retirement or this pays your bills, right? All of it's your livelihood. The moment that you decide you want to earn something off of your books, as opposed to just here, like, let me give you a story. Right. The moment you decide you want to make any money off of it, you need to recognize that it's a business, because to make that money, you've got to figure out how to let people know. And that takes effort. And I believe in the 80-20 rule, but not exactly the way that most people think of it. You know, the 20% of your work should make 80% of your gains. Well, 80% of your writing business is doing what's going to get you, you know, the gains, and 20% of it is writing time. it might be 60-40, 70-30, but there is more that goes into the business side than people anticipate. And so it's very easy to be overwhelmed by it. So what I tell clients that I work with, you know, let's make sure you understand the different things that happen in the publishing process and not just getting your book through an editor. You know, I don't work with people on that end. I'm more the business side. So what are the different things that happen in a marketing plan? And let's think about how we can learn about these things incrementally and implement them incrementally, because Rome wasn't built in a day. You right. can't learn all the things in one day, and you can't implement all the things in one day. So what are the manageable bite-sized pieces that you can learn or you can do, but inevitably it's going to fall on your shoulders. Even if you're trad, you need to know who your readership is. You need to know where they are. You need to know what appeals to them and how to talk to them, whether it's in your newsletter, social media, in a live event, whatever it is. You know, marketing is the planning, the research and planning of getting a book into a marketplace, right? So you have to do that regardless of how you're publishing. And so, you know, bite-sized chunks until you have a whole picture of it.
Right. You began your writing career writing Highlander romance. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And your main focus today, under Celeste Barkley, at least, is Highlander romance still. And you've branched a little bit, but that's still kind of your prime focus, right?
It is. So when I first started reading historical romance, which was only a couple of years before I started writing mm-hmm. it, I read Regency and I liked them. And then I stumbled across Highlanders and I realized I really liked the ruggedness of those stories, of the characters, you know, the suspense of it. I still enjoy Regency, but Highlanders called to me. And so that's what I wrote. And case in point of not doing my research properly, in my head, because I read Highlanders, I also like Vikings. It wasn't a far stretch for me to be like, if you like Highlanders, you're probably going to like Vikings. Not so much.
Yeah.
Vikings is quite a smaller niche. And you know what happens when you assume? I made an assumption.
Right.
So I finished my first 6-book Highlander series, and I decided I wanted to write a Viking series. So I did. And I definitely had climbed, and then I kind of went down. And now that I'm a very established historical brand, my Vikings do very well. But I definitely had to rebuild because I didn't understand the full consequences of that choice that I made. So I'm happy I did it because that series still sells. But in the moment, it was kind of like, you know, Celeste, like you do, yes, you come from education, but you also have a background in PR. You should have figured this out. You should have looked a little deeper rather than making assumptions. So I went back to writing Highlanders, and I had an opportunity to join 2 anthologies for pirates. And so I did. And when those retired, I took what was novellas and, you know, lengthened them into full novels and released them. And I thought it was just going to be a duet. And then readers were like, well, what about the first mates? When are they going to get their story? And I was like, oh,
what?
Let me work on that.
Right.
So that ended up going from a duet to a quadruple, if you will, a 4-book series. And my the Highland Ladies series, again, that was supposed to be 10 books, but readers were like, well, what about so-and-so and so-and-so? Ended up 15 books that I have since cut in half and made 8 and 7 because I was concerned that over time there might become series fatigue because they are not brand new. People are not chasing the newest release. And I was concerned that people would see, you know, oh, this is book 11. Do I need to go all the way back to book 1 or can I join in here? Minor standalones, but it's still a reasonable concern for people. So, you know, things that I learned along the way, but I do keep coming back to Highlanders. That's my happy place. In real life, I love the Highlands. In my book, I love it. The Regencies came about because of anthology opportunities as well. It's nice to dabble there, but when it comes to historical, Celeste writes medieval, which in of itself, from a business perspective, is a challenge. Medieval is smaller, it makes less than Regency. So, you know, those are things that are part of my business practice that I have to be mindful of.
Okay. One thing that I love about your story is that while these things are happening, I'm sure that you felt at some point, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, please correct me if I'm wrong, but when you set off to do the Viking story and you talked about, you know, riding the crest of success and then, you know, thinking, oh goodness, what have I done? And these are not things that are not daily things that you can course correct. You're talking about series, and these things take time to write, time to publish. And if you make a misstep, they take time to course correct. And if someone may look at this and think, oh, I've had success with this first series, and now I've ventured over here, and it's not doing what I hoped that it would, my career's over. Like there's no hope. And what I'm hearing for you is that there's absolutely hope. Okay. I did something different. It took a little time, but I got back. I found my readers again, and now they love this left turn that I took with Vikings. But, you know, it was all about knowing your audience and having earned their trust, maybe. I'm sure it's much easier to look at in hindsight than it was in the moment when you realized, oh my goodness, what have I done and how do I fix this? Can you talk a little bit about the writing career, the publishing career, and how you can depend on the readers that you have earned, so that when you do make these turns that are maybe not as popular today as they eventually will be, how do you survive those things?
So in the case of the Vikings, I broke the scientific method and I changed two variables at once. I changed the subgenre and I changed my release. So for the end of my first series, I released the last three books a month apart, right?
Okay.
I fed the monster, if you will, the voracious readers. And then the Vikings came along and I was like, oh, I've got a readership. I can go down to one a quarter. I can slow down a little bit. So not only did I slow down with my release, I also changed what I was offering. So had I continued to rapid release Vikings, I might not have seen the dip. If I had continued writing Highlanders but slowed down, maybe I wouldn't have seen the dip. But when I put those two factors together, it was not a well-researched approach. I treated it as a business at that point, but I still was not thinking strategically enough. It hadn't dawned on me how strategic and how far out I needed to think about these things. And so, you know, if you have what you feel is a misstep, right? Mm-hmm. And either you didn't research enough before you chose to do something, or you did, and it just didn't pan out the way that you thought, you know, don't abandon the IP that you have, because once it's there, it is always yours. You can decide what you want to do with it. I truly believe that no word is a wasted word. If you can't use it in the manuscript right then and there, put it in a file, see if you can repurpose it for another book. But you work too darn hard to come up with those words to toss them out. You know, put them in the recycling bin, not in the trash. So when you realize that you need to make a course correction, it's not that you should dump what you have or what you have is wrong. You need to think about, okay, well, what did work for me and how can I move back to that and even bring this along with me? So for me, I write a huge interconnected world, right? And I have created a way where my Vikings are descendants of one of the Highland clans that I write about. So I'm able to kind of push back and make references to the Vikings from my Highland series, not necessarily the other way around, because I didn't realize when I was writing the Viking series that I would need to do that. But my course correction has been to hint at it in some of the Highlander books that there's a connection. And then in one of them, I specifically explain it. And so I can tell readers, hey, if you want to find out where the Clan Sinclair and Clan Mackay came from, read the Vikings. Oh, you read the Vikings and you want to find out what happens? Jump into my Highlanders. So I find ways to mesh them so that nothing's left off and wasted, if you will. So there's always ways to pull yourself back on course. And no matter how well you plan, things happen. Things don't work out the way that you want. And I, for me, am a very start to finish person. I'm a linear writer. When I start a task, I like to do it all the way through completion until I start something new. I can multitask, but I'm my own boss and nobody's telling me I have to. So if I don't want to, I don't. But I'm also the person who, you know, in high school, when I took the SAT, I didn't understand the consequences of if you got it wrong. So skip the ones you don't know. It's on the paper. So I need to answer every question. I understand now that that's not necessarily the way business works. Sometimes you've got to skip something if you don't know how to do it and pursue what is working for you. So being open to the idea that, you know, maybe you're on this path and you take a detour, but you will come back around. And, you know, I have some folks, some friends who will say, oh, well, you know, I stopped this series because it was failing. And that's fine. Write something else. But don't forget about those books that, quote unquote, failed, because, again, it's your IP. It's out there. It's not going to vanish. It's yours to do what you want with. So maybe you course correct, you get yourself back on track, and then you start, you know, giving these ones that were a failure some extra love. But nothing, again, no word is wasted. We work way too hard to come up with them to ever abandon them.
Right. Celeste, you have become a trusted voice in writing and publishing when it comes to building reader loyalty. At what point in your publishing career did you realize that you had established a relationship with your readers and that they would trust you and they would follow you in different things that you were going to try? When did that kind of click with you that, oh, I have earned people's trust now?
You know, it was a progression. So like I said, I took that detour into Highlanders, and some of the Highlander readers that I had cultivated came over to Vikings with me. Mm-hmm. Not all of them did, but just seeing that some of them did was the first, you know, boost. Then when I went back to Highlanders and I kind of regained the people that I had lost, I was like, oh, they were patient with me for a year. They're willing to give me another try. You know, and my series have different feels. Like, they might be very family oriented. Mm-hmm. They might be very social message oriented, whatever it is. You know, variety is the spice of life. I can't keep writing the same story over and over again. Sure. There has to be some variety in there. So when I see them following me because they like my writing style and my storytelling style, but the series may have different feelings or vibes to them, even though it's still the same subgenre, then I know that they're loyal to me. And I had 2020 was the year that I was like, I'm going to build my backlist, because backlist back in the day. So I released a book a month along with, you know, so that was the Highland Ladies series. Plus I had the pirates in there as well. And I got to, I think it was August, and I was tired. I was still building my endurance for these things. And I write long. My books are generally 75 to 110, 120, depending on if they're historical or mafia.
Yeah.
But these are long books, you know, and I write very fast, but it is tiring. And so I told my readers, I was like, you know what? I just need a month off. I'm sorry. I'm not going to get this book out in August like I thought I was. My readers were like, take a break. It's all right. We'll be here. You've given us plenty of it already.
Nothing else is going on in the world in 2020.
So. Well, yeah, there was that as well. But, you know, it was one of those things where it was like, okay, then I have in fact connected with readers well enough and they like the product that I have well enough that they are going to come back to me. So I knew that they were brand loyal because they kept, you know, buying my books as I released them. But then when I took a pause and I slowed down, you know, even if it was just a month, there's thousands of books that are going to come out in the space of a month, right? When they came back to me, I knew I had brand affinity. I knew that it wasn't just that they were loyal, they were going to keep buying me because it was there. They had an affinity for me. So they were going to come back even if they had moved on to something else. And I am banking on that now because my mafias have taken off. I'm writing and focusing on those more. And this year I'm slowing down with the historicals because quite frankly, from a business point of view, Mafia is making me a lot more than Highlanders, but I love writing Highlanders. And I have a loyal readership that I've spent 6 years building and cultivating. But because of that affinity, I know that if I slow down and only do one or two Highlander books, I'm not going to lose people. I have 40 odd Highlander books and Vikings and Pirates and Regency out there, my historicals. If people like me, they like me, right? I've kept going with this. So if I slow down to one or two books, those people who have already bought into me and have read all of those historicals are going to be okay with me slowing down. They're not going to forget me at this point. I don't have the same concerns now with that huge backlist as I would have, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago. So it has been about working hard to connect with readers and, you know, helping to build those relationships with them where they can trust me, they can trust the stories I'm going to give them. And if those stories happen to slow down a little bit, that's okay because they're going to come back to me. That's what I hope.
Right. Fingers crossed with you. What was the decision like to spin up the pen name Sabine and do the mafia romance? I would imagine you're, you know, armpit deep in Highlanders and mafias, very different. What was that decision?
No, it's
like?
Really not.
No? Okay.
It's not. So all y'all out there may not like
historicals. Window dressing is different. Is that what you're saying?
Well, for those of you who may not like historical, let me tell you, mafia romance is medieval romance in present day. If you love kilts and swords, you can love suits and guns. If you love suits and guns, you can love swords and kilts. Because at the heart of it, it's still the same feelings. It's still the same emotions that are evoked. It's just a different time and place. It really is so similar in so many ways that, you know, first of all, historical romance is not what a lot of people think it is. We are not writing their granny's love stories anymore. We have evolved. Sure. So it wasn't as huge a stretch as one might think. I have a friend who had written a mafia book. She's a historical romance author, but she'd written a mafia book and it was my friend. So I read it and I was like, I'm down with this. I like this. And I went to see if she had more and it turned out it was one installment in a multi-author project. So I read a few more and I was like, oh, I really like these. So I read a whole bunch more and that was December of 2021, something like that. And January of 2022, I'm with a small house. I messaged my publisher and I said, so I'm also going to write, I'm going to write Mafia and I'm going to juggle the two. And it's January now. I'd like to release the first Mafia book the end of June in time for the 4th of July. And then I'm going to release 6 books every 6 weeks. So can we fit that in? Because that's how I roll. And it has worked for me. For me, it's been a very logical transition because, again, the feelings are still there. That clan or organization, syndicate, comes first. That you serve both of those. That, you know, you have these alpha, but not alpha whole, alpha heroes who are going to do whatever it takes to defend their family, their clan, you know, their partner, whatever it is, that there's going to be rivalries between the syndicates and the clans, that, you know, I write very independent heroines on both sides, because in the real world, you know, from the medieval side, part of the reason why I like that better than Regency is when these men rode out to battle, there was no way to know if they were coming home. But you had an entire village and castle and clan to run that fell on the women's shoulders. And it's sort of the same thing with mafia. If you're going to marry into a mafioso family or a mob family or a brothel family or a cartel family, you know, it is not for the faint of heart. So they're very, very similar in a lot of ways. And so it was a very logical transition to me. But from a business perspective, contemporary romance is bigger than historical. And so it makes a lot more money for me.
Wow. So.
I'm very passionate about it.
That you are. It sounds like that you are a fast writer and that you appreciate and love the fast release. What does a typical workday look like for you?
So I'm going to preface this by saying that it wasn't until like 2 years ago when I started meeting other authors on Clubhouse, this audio only app, mm-hmm. that I realized I'm even more of an odd duck than I realized, that other people don't work the way that I do. I mean, I knew I had a long attention span.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how atypical I am until I started talking to other people. So I'm in my office right now. I'm at my desk, but usually I have neck issues. I usually sit in my recliner, maybe on the futon. I work there. I start work and I work until the work is done. So that might be 4 hours because I've got other things I've got to leave the house to do. Or it could be 10 hours. It could be 12 hours. It could be 14 hours. You know, if I say I'm good with 8,000 words, then I might stop at 7 hours. But if I'm on a day where I'm like, I got to get 12,000, I've got to get 15, I've got to catch up, I've got to get 20, then it could be a 10, 12 or 14 hour day, but I'm going to work until the work is done. I'm not easily distracted. Every few hours, I'll give myself like a 10, 15 minute Facebook break just to decompress for a moment. Even if I start to fall down a rabbit hole for research, and I do research for both my mafia and my historicals, I'm able to reel myself back in and it doesn't become a time suck. So I've been asked, you know, how are you so productive? And could you teach how to be that productive? Could you write a book on it? Well, it would be one page. Sit your keister down and get on with it. Like, I don't have a better way to explain it because I'm a very internally motivated person. Mm-hmm. I'm rather autotelic from that point of view of being able to focus, you know, and be internally motivated and be satisfied with that internal motivation. And I get that that's not everybody, but it is for me. You know, if I give myself a task, then it needs to get done. And it really does not matter whether I'd rather watch a Real Housewives episode, because that's my guilty pleasure, or, you know, whatever it is. I can do that when I finish my task, but this is my job. This is not my hobby. This is what I do. So just like anybody else who would leave the house and go work 8 to 5, or somebody who'd go into their home office and work 8 to 5, this is what I do. And the majority of the time it is writing, but there's also business stuff to be done too. But there's no real great secret other than sit your keister down and get on with it.
I love it. Celeste, if folks are just discovering you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you're up to, is there a central place on the internet to go look you up, or is there a combination of what would you tell someone who just wants to find out all about what you're up to?
So the easiest place would be to just go to CelesteBarkley.com.
Okay.
You know, that is the big brand, right? If you're curious about my mafia stuff, then go to SabineBarkley.com. But if you're looking for me in the grander scheme of things, that would be the place to go. For social media, I do tend to be on Facebook more than Instagram, or TikTok, but you can find me and message me on any of those platforms. You can Google me. I come up. I've got a lot of books. They come up. I am a KU author for the most part, so you can always look for me there. But I try to be very responsive to messages. If you email me through the contact sheet on my website, I try to get back to you, you know, within 48 to 72 business hours. I'm trying really hard to take weekends. It's not easy, but I'm trying. So yeah, I'm out there.
Great. And we will link up all those places in the show notes to make it easy for folks to find you. And we'll also link up your Amazon pages as well, because like you said, you are a KU author. Super easy to find one of your series and just dive headfirst in. So we'll link those up as well. Celeste, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy day. And I know you have a trip coming up that you've got to pack for. Will you be making some personal appearances?
Yes. So I am attending Rare Paris this weekend. That is reader author romance events. It is a series of different signings all over the world. This one happens to be in Paris. So I will be there. If you head to my website and you look under the About section, I do have a page that shows all of my upcoming events for this year, whether it's conferences I'm attending or speaking engagements, signings, things like that. So there's plenty. If you're in Paris this weekend, hello. I will also have signings in St. Louis, Phoenix, Vegas, LA Festival of Books in 2 weeks. So I'm globetrotting this year.
Globetrotting. I love it. Celeste, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the time and the invitation.
That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.